So we're down to the last two chapters of Joshua. This is it. And 23 and 24 are two retirement speeches. I was thinking, you know, I'm sure I will retire someday, somewhere 70, 75. I think that's kind of about where pastors tend to call it quits. Joshua was just a tad older than that when he finally called it quits. Just a smidge. You want to take a guess, Abby? As your
well, he was a spy, so they had to put him. I would think they wouldn't trust that to anyone under the age of 20-ish.
He was a lot older than that 40? When he was a spy. He was 40, about 40.
And he wandered around the wilderness for 40 years, so we're at least up to 80. We've been campaigning for about 7 years, so we're heading towards 90.
You're a little on the low side.
I'm figuring so.
He was 85, roughly. In chapter 13. So here, this, from all we can tell, he is somewhere between 85 and 110. We know it. So, and this, from the looks of it, it's probably closer to the 110 stage than the 85. And I think somewhere after 100, probably a good time to slow down. Now, it starts off, and it came about after many days when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side. And Joshua was old, advanced in years, that Joshua called for all Israel, for their elders and their heads and their judges and their officers, and said to them, I am old, advanced in years. And you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you. See, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off, from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. The Lord your God, he will thrust them out from before you and drive them from before you, and you will possess their land just as the Lord your God promised you. Now, when he says, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies, that looks back to chapter 21, verse 44. And the Lord gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn their fathers. And no one of all their enemies stood before them. And the Lord gave all their enemies into their hands. So here we have a period of peace. Right? And remember that there are still Gentile nations that survived within the land. They have not all been cleared out. But there is peace. And this is God. God has given them peace. Joshua, in this period of peace, he's gathered together the people. Right? And here it says all Israel, right? But then it goes lists out these different levels of rulers. And so this is not actually the entire nation that's been called together. These are the rulers from all of the tribes that are being gathered. And this is all of the rulers. It seems to be every level of society, every kind of ruler has been brought together. So this is from one leader to the leadership of Israel. And he starts with this summary of events, things that they have lived through, they have experienced, they have seen. And these are the things that we've already covered in our study of Joshua. Right? This is kind of that saying, seeing is believing. Right, they have seen God's conquest of the land. Right, they have seen the victory that comes only from God. And they've seen it done in miraculous ways that it wasn't them. You know, we've got the hailstones that wiped out more of the opposing military than they had killed. Right, there were things that were very clearly God going before them. And so Joshua, he just reminds them, it's been 20, 30 years, and he says, remember, God did this. This is his work. And then we see in verse 4, he reminds them what's left, what still remains. He says, see, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off, from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. Now, half the book of Joshua is dedicated to the apportioning of the lands. That's a significant chunk. Chapters 13 to 21, it's all about who gets what piece of land. And he breaks, you know, as he's laid this out, he gives two categories for apportioning. Any of you want to tell me what two categories we have up in our passage here? No, no. He has two categories right here in chapter 23. He has for the allotment. Mm-hmm. It's what they have taken and what they haven't taken yet. Right. And but notice, it's already been divided. Even those lands that they have not conquered yet, or those areas that they haven't defeated and driven out, that land's already been divided up. Right. And the different chunks that are yet to be beaten, that belongs to particular tribes, even if they have not yet driven them out. So the whole thing already belongs to Israel, even if they don't have actual possession of its entirety yet. But the whole thing belongs to them. Joshua has led them in defeating, you know, what has been conquered so far. But he reminds them, you know, look around you. There's still these areas of resistance, and God will conquer. God will continue to do what he has already done. And they can look at the lands that they already possess and see in that the encouragement that the lands that they haven't conquered yet will become theirs. So this should give them the confidence and the will to continue on and finish the job. And this is kind of a matter of inertia, momentum. Inertia is this basic principle that an object at rest will remain at rest unless it's acted on by an outside force. It's a basic science principle, and it works with people. Right? People tend to not do things unless acted on by an outside force to push them into motion. Right? And they've stopped. It's been 20, 25 years, and they're enjoying their peace. They're enjoying their rest. And Joshua says, that's good. That's God's blessing. But you can't remain stopped. You have to finish the job. All right. Verses 6 to 10. Says, be very strong then to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you will not associate with these nations, these which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you are to cling to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. For the Lord has driven out great and strong nations from before you. And as for you, no man has stood before you to this day. One of your men puts to flight 1,000, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he promised you. The command here, and this is one of those things you look at in translations, go, why'd you do that? All right, when he says be very and firm is just not the right word here. All right, it's be very strong. And we've seen this command given several times in Joshua. All right, it's the book starts off with this command in Joshua 1:6-9, God says this three times to Joshua, be strong and courageous. And this is the same word here, be very strong. All right? This is the same thing the people told Joshua in Joshua 1:18, as they encouraged him as a new leader, be strong. All right? And then Joshua then turned around and told the people the same thing in Joshua 10:25, be strong. So this is the same thing. He had just 2-3 decades later, he's reminding them, be strong. Right? And here there's added then, and this is the first time we've seen it, it's just be very strong. So there's more emphasis here. Right? This is, if possible, even more important. But he says, be strong about keeping the law. Right? Now, it's not so much now about be strong in facing battle and conquest. That's still yet to be done. But he says, be strong in keeping the law. Right? And then he says, all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. Does that tell us anything? Any details we might ascertain from that? Little things.
Well, again, from emphasizing Moses, but also the book of the law of Moses, as if there was another law that might be followed. Because he seems to be sure it's very specific as to which one he's.
That might be. I was looking at more of the fact that there is one book, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. We typically break that down into five books. And as far as Joshua is concerned, that's one book. Genesis to Deuteronomy with five chapters. And it's probably written on different scrolls, but it was still considered one book. Right? That's the law of Moses. So it becomes a bit of a hermeneutical thing when we deal with the Pentateuch then, or you have to deal with it kind of as a whole, right, rather than breaking it down. It's one piece. So they have at hand what they need. They have this law that's been given to them, and if they are strong in keeping that law, they will not turn away. So they have everything they need right there. All they have to do is stick with it. Now, in this context, what's it mean to not turn away from the law?
I'm not sure everything he wants about the next couple of verses.
Now, it's a parallel saying. So when he says, do not turn away from to the right or to the left, that next so that is what he has in mind. Don't associate with the nations. Don't talk about their gods. Don't make people swear by these foreign gods. Now, who are they going to make swear by the foreign gods' names? What does that mean?
Covenants.
With whom?
With the outsiders.
Yes. Right. Remember, we've got, and some of these people, even though they've not been driven out, they've been subjugated. Right. And when they subjugate them and make them swear fealty, who do they swear by? He says, don't make them swear by their own gods. That's not a valid covenant. If you're going to make them swear, make them swear by Yahweh, by the God of the Israelites. So don't make them swear by their own gods. And then don't serve those foreign gods, don't bow down to them. Rather, cling to the Lord, cling to Yahweh. He says, as you have done to this day. And that's a really encouraging statement right there. You have been doing the right thing. You've been sticking with the Lord. Keep doing that. Keep holding on tight. And of course, you know, if you were here last week, you saw your dad's demonstration of the idea of clinging tight, holding on tight. And anytime you get two cultures that border up against each other, there's this kind of intermingling of customs and language. Language, they blur into what are called pidgins, and pidgins become creoles, and those are technical terms for a mishmash of languages that happens on borders. There are marriages that happen between peoples, even though parents on both sides disagree, kids manage to get attracted to people of other cultures. And we're going to see this. We're going to see this someday when we get around to Judges. What'd Samson do? he falls in love with a Philistine girl, and his dad says, "No, really, let's find you a good Jewish girl, good Israelite girl." And Samson, "No, I want that one." But that's what Joshua was talking about. He says, "Don't do that." And Samson turns around and says, "No, I want what I want, what I want." So here there's this unspoken implication that God has gone before them because they have clung to the Lord. And as long as they continue, hold fast to God, and they don't turn away to other gods, he is going to continue to go before them, to continue to help them conquer the land. All right. They've had, it's almost an illogical success, it's unreasonable success, as they have defeated overwhelming odds. And that's been God, and he will continue to do that as long as they continue to remain faithful. Verses 11 to 13. "So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God. For if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you will associate with them and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you, but they will be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you." So Joshua, remember, he's talking to the leaders here. He tells these leaders, love God. Right, he started off with obey the law. Right, but this is a step beyond that. Love God. Having this strong emotional investment as a response for what God has done for them. So this is not just a mechanical obedience, but this is a relationship with God. And that's what he is exhorting them to do. And why is this important?
Because they're going to do this very thing for the next 400 years.
Because, you know, and here, loving God seems to be the proof against intermingling with the nations. Right? If you love God, you won't do these things. Right? But as the love wanes, these other things happen, and that's the book of Judges.
Yeah, right? But all the way down, we get back into Jeremiah.
When it goes far enough. Right? As they intermingle with the Gentiles, and God's no longer going to drive those Gentiles out, and the Gentiles, those nations, become a trap for Israel. And that's Judges right there. Right? The people do what's right in their own eyes for a little bit, and then God disciplines them, and they say, "Oh, you're right, God," and it lasts for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and then they turn around and they do the same thing over and over and over. Right? And of course, in, as you mentioned, and then it comes to the point that we get to Jeremiah, and we see with Jeremiah when they are cut off from the land. Right? And that's the thing that Joshua talks about right here. Verse 14 to 16. "Now behold, today I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you has failed. All have been fulfilled for you, not one of them has failed. It shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats until he has destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. When you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, and then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you will perish quickly from off the good land which he has given you." So what's it mean that to go the way of all the earth? What's that mean? You're going to die. Everybody dies. It's just the normal, natural course of things now, post-Adam. Everybody dies. And Joshua is old enough that he says, "Yeah, my time's here. I'm done," which is part of why I think we're closer to 110 than 85. But God has kept all of his promises that he made regarding these people. Now, that's not saying he has done everything that he has promised, But he has fulfilled all the promises that he's made to this people. And he says, look around you. The evidence of those promises that he has kept, the blessings that he has given, is also evidence that he will also keep all the curses. So anytime you think about wandering, just look at the blessings you have and know that God will follow through on the curses as well, just as much as he's followed through on his blessings. And then Joshua, he repeats himself. That means don't forget. He says it three times. All right? If you don't, all right, the Lord's going to drive you out. He says, until he has destroyed you from off this good land. He says that three times. So look at the blessing that you have, this gift that God has given us, this holy land, because that's what's at stake. All right? God can take away what he has given. And we see that in Jeremiah. But that's how this first note, this first speech ends. Right there. You've got it now, but you can lose it. And chapter 24, it's another farewell speech. It has the same group of elders and leaders, but now we have the rest of the people there as well. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for all the elders of Israel and for their heads and their judges and their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, from ancient times your father lived beyond the river, namely Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau, and to Esau I gave Mount Seir to possess it, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt by what I did in its midst. And afterward I brought you out. I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea, and Egypt pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea." Now, this second farewell speech happens at Shechem. Any of you remember some of the other significance to Shechem? Other things that have happened at Shechem?
Is that the blessing and the cursing?
It is the blessing and the cursing. All right, but it actually goes further back. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 6 and 7, this is the site where God promised the land of Canaan to Abraham, right here, where this farewell speech is happening. In Joshua 20, verse 7, all right, it was set, Shechem was set aside as a city of refuge. So this is the Levites' city. Right, and when it says, gathered the people and they came presented themselves before the Lord, this is a Levite city. This is not where the tabernacle is at, but it's quite likely that the Ark of the Covenant was here. The before the Lord statement typically goes with where the Ark of the Covenant is found. But in Joshua 8, 30 to 35, we have the covenant that's read with the people on the two mountains. And if you look at the map there with Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, that's right there where Shechem's at. So they weren't in Shechem proper because they were on the two sides of the valley, but that's where they were at, the same place. And here at the very end of the book, we have this reminder that Joshua is a prophet. Right? And here he is speaking to the people with this prophetic, "Thus says the Lord." So as he speaks, he is speaking the message that God has given him for the people. What a wonderful way to close out your ministry. And here, God's message is to remind them of his faithfulness to Israel as a people. And there's this series of I statements. I did, I gave. And these are all the things of God acting for this people. And this goes all the way back to Abraham. It actually precedes Abraham when, and look at Nahor and Abraham's family. But within that context of Nahor, I brought Abraham. Now, each act in each descendant, each act God did, each descendant God gave. And then we get to Esau, and we see that Edom, Mount Seir, that's Edom. Right? Edom was given to Esau. That is Esau's inheritance. But where Esau's descendants got their inheritance early, Jacob's descendants, Israel, had to wait. They went through Egypt, but God brought them out of Egypt with the Exodus. I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea, and Egypt pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. But when they cried out to the Lord, he put darkness between you and the Egyptians and brought the sea upon them and covered them. And your own eyes saw what I did in Egypt, and you lived in the wilderness for a long time. Then I brought you into the land of the Amorites who lived beyond the Jordan, and they fought with you. And I gave them into your hand, and you took possession of their land when I destroyed them before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose and fought against Israel. And he sent and summoned Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I was not willing to listen to Balaam, so he had to bless you, and I delivered you from his hand. God continues going on this list of things that he has done for them. And this is, if you think about it, this is kind of a summary of Genesis, Exodus. We're all the way up to Numbers. I think he skipped Leviticus. Right? But the narrative parts, he's up to Numbers now. Right? And there's this interesting deviation. There's a shift here, a discrepancy. I wonder if any of you picked up on it.
He's talking about Balak and Balaam before they got into the land. Coming around.
Well, that was, but that.
That's 3 years.
Mm-hmm. We look at verse 7, he says, but when they cried out to the Lord, he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. Up until now, we've had I statements. I did this, I did this, I did this. Cried out to the Lord, he did this. I did this, I did this, I did this. And so there's, and what I've looked through with commentaries and journals and stuff, one person acknowledged that shift, but nobody seems to make anything with it. And I don't know if it's just a grammar thing because you called out to the Lord and then so that we've got third person object, so we have to have a third person subject to continue it on, or if there's maybe a hint of the Trinity here, and this is the Son that's speaking through Joshua, and they called out to the Father. I don't know, right? But it's an interesting little sidetrack grammatically. Just not sure what to make of it, but it's there. And then God skips from the Exodus to the defeat of Sihon and Og, giving Israel the land east of the Jordan at their request. He reminds them of Balak and Balaam and how God bent Balaam to his will. Right? Because Balaam, of course, wanted the money for cursing. Right? But God didn't let him do it. And then God moves into these more recent events that we've seen in the book of Joshua. You crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the citizens of Jericho fought against you. And the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Girgashite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Thus I gave them into your hand. Then I sent the hornet before you and drove it out, and it drove out the two kings of the Amorites from before you, but not by your sword or your bow. I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and the cities which you had not built. And you have lived in them, and you are eating of vineyards and olive groves, which you did not plant. Right. Now, is in God's quick summary, are we missing any significant steps here?
We kind of skimmed over a whole Mount Sinai thing, and a lot of the problems that the Israelites had.
There is a definite glossing over of the shortcomings. And there is one significant shortcoming especially that's not mentioned here.
The wandering.
The wandering. Right. He says you lived in the desert for a long time, but that's before they have the defeat of the Amorite kings. He's completely skipped the fact that Israel said, we don't want to go in, we want to go back to Egypt. He just kind of left that one out. He's hitting the high points where they have been faithful, where God has done these things. And then we have this hornet in verse 12. And I don't think it was the green hornet. Can anybody tell me what that's about? I don't know. Now, I can tell you.
A hornet, like it's not like a group of hornets, it's a hornet.
A hornet. I don't know. But it's an allusion to Exodus 23, verses 28 to 30. There he says, I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. All right, so there in Exodus, God says, I'm going to do this slowly. So as the people have the Canaanites still in the land, that's not entirely unexpected. Right? Because God said, I will do this phased over time. The reference to hornet goes back to that prophecy. But I don't know what the hornet is. The only thing I can associate with it says, I will send the hornet before you, and it drove out the two kings of the Amorites. Right, and that's not talking Sihon and Og. They're already dead. As God's laid this out, this is after coming into the land. This is on the Israel side of the Jordan. The only connection I can make is there were those five kings that gathered together when we had the defection, and they said, well, we've got to do something about this, and God defeated so many with the hailstorm. Right, that's the big place where it's pointed out that God fought instead of the people. It seems to me, and this is reading into a little bit, but I'm guessing that two of those kings were significant and the other three were add-ons. But that's I still don't know how to tie a hornet to that event other than that seems to be the point that God's talking about. But God has given them the land. This is from start to finish. This is God working in Israel being blessed. Verse 14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord our God is he who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, and who did these great signs in our sight and preserved us all the way through all the way in which we went, and among all the peoples through whose midst we passed. The Lord drove out from before us all the peoples, even the Amorites who lived in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. All right, so there's a shift now from speaking prophetically, right, thus says the Lord, and now we have Joshua's exhortation on the basis of that prophecy. He says, let's make this stick, and you've got to decide. Right, when it comes down to it, this is a matter of volition. They have to make a choice. And they can choose either to worship the God who has done all of these things, or they can follow other deities. And he lists out kind of their three options. They've got the Mesopotamian deities. Those are across the river. Right, and it goes back to Nahor across the river. All right, so that's the Mesopotamian deities. Or we've got the Egyptian deities or the Amorite deities. All right, well, the Egyptian deities and Amorite deities have already shown themselves to be thoroughly impotent when it comes to opposing God. Right? God does whatever he wants, whether he's in Egypt or whether he's in the Amorite lands. Right? But if you want, go do that. But make a choice. choose. And of course, he says, this is my choice. My household and I, we're going to serve the Lord. But you need to make your choice. And they follow Joshua's lead. They say, yes, we are going to do as you do. We are going to serve the Lord. And there's this, you know, this is that sticking point, that commitment that we just decide, this is who we are, this is what we're going to do, and follow through on to the end. Verse 19, then Joshua said to the people, you will not be able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgression or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done good to you. The people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Lord. Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourself that you have chosen for yourselves the Lord to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. Now therefore, put away the foreign gods which are in your midst and incline your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. So Joshua says, you're not going to be able to keep the covenant. And looking back from the perspective of the cross and Acts, we look back and say, yep, they couldn't do it. They couldn't. But, you know, that's played out in Judges where Joshua says, you're not going to do it. And sure enough, they didn't. And then we get this kind of troubling statement. God says, not going to forgive your sins. What do we do with this? No guesses? And this looks ahead to 2 Kings 24:2. And this is Manasseh. Right here. This is talking about Manasseh, who slaughtered people. He was a bloody king. He even killed his own children. And God says, I'm not going to forgive him. And then he wouldn't forgive him so he could pour out the full extent of his punishment. And the people say, no, we will serve God. We will not fall away. And they testify this fact that when they fall away, God's going to remind them of this commitment. That's that we are witnesses. That's what that's saying. He says, put away the idols that are in your midst. And here we've already seen the statement, you have been clean. Keep doing that. And so this isn't that they are also worshiping idols. That's not going on. But it seems that they may still be in possession of idols, even if they aren't worshiping them. And their slaves, certainly the conquered nations, are probably holding on to them. He says, get rid of them. Don't hold on to those. Those are going to be a stumbling block. So clean house. Take out the trash, because God's a jealous God, and you don't want that stuff causing problems. People said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord our God, and we will obey his voice. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these books in the law of God, in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. Joshua said to the people, behold, the stone shall be a witness against us, for he has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. Thus it shall be a witness against you, for a witness against you, so that you do not deny your God. Then Joshua dismissed the people, each to his own inheritance. All right, and so we have this record. You know, he records this for posterity, quite literally, both by writing it down and by setting up this monument. And this is the second monument in the book of Joshua. We had one at the beginning, when they came into the land. So coming into the land, we've got the monument, the pile of stones from the Jordan River to remind them of what God has done there. Now we have a monument in Shechem that God has fulfilled his promises and the people are going to adhere to him. And both these are done so that future generations can look at that monument and remember the commitment that the people have made to the Lord. Verses 29 to 33, and it came about after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Serah, which is in the hill country of Ephraim on the north of Mount Gash. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, and had known all the deeds of the Lord which he had done before, done for Israel. Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt at Shechem, in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money, and they became in the inheritance of Joseph's sons. And Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him at Gibeah of Phinehas his son, which was given him in the hill country of Ephraim. So the book closes with this summary of Joshua's death. He was 110 when he died, and they buried him in his own lands in Ephraim. And then there's this transition. We've got one burial, and then it goes into the other burial, which is also in Ephraim land. And this is the burial of Joseph, which goes all the way back to the end of Genesis and Joseph's request. He says, when you go back, bury me. So they have brought the bones of Joseph with them. He's been traveling for a while. And he's finally laid to rest in the land that his father, Jacob, bought. And that's his resting place. And then as long as we're talking about burials, we have a third burial. We've got the burial of Eleazar in Phinehas' land. And there I stop and say, wait a second, okay, that's interesting. What is that, the minor, again, a little thing, but what's that tell us? There's a misconception here. Normally, who do we say survived the years of wandering? Joshua and Caleb. And apparently, Eleazar lived through that also. The high priest and Phinehas. Unless Phinehas was under 20 when he was enthusiastic and passionately stopped the spread of the plague, which is possible. He may have been a very young man then. Right, but at least we have at least three men that made it past the 40 years because we have the high priest as well. So I had never made that connection before, but it's at least Joshua, Caleb, and Eleazar, and possibly Phinehas. So Joshua dies having been faithful his whole life. It's something we each can aspire and hold fast to. Thank you.